Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Good afternoon. My name is Paul, and I'm an adult husband of a grateful member of Al-Anon. I don't think Al-Anon ought to be allowed to tell dumb jokes like that. Like Max, I don't tell jokes either. Mainly because I can't remember jokes. That's not really true. I can remember any joke, but then I have to give up one of the other two that I remember. I know a poem, though. You want to hear my poem? I think you'd hear it no matter what you'd said, but I'm not very cultured. I know one poem, and it's a real good poem too. Very appropriate. The whiskey was spilled on the barroom floor, and the bar was closed for the night. A little gray mouse crept out of his hole to dance in the pale moonlight. He lapped up the whiskey on the barroom floor, and back on his haunches he sat. And all night long you could hear him roar, "Bring on that goddamn cat." I could tell by looking at you, you were the cultural type people. I knew you liked the finer things here in San Francisco. Hadn't this been a great weekend so far? Yeah. Good. Good news is most everybody's had a good time. The bad news is if you haven't, it's your own damn fault. Yeah. An attitude is just about everything. And as a matter of fact, this being the last meeting of the whole weekend, it's by the power vested in me as your last speaker, I pronounce all of you charter members of the Spirit of San Francisco. What that entitles you to is free entrance to every hospitality room hereafter. And it also obligates you to come back every year and bring all your friends. So it just keeps getting better and better. It's a lot of work to do something like this, especially the first time. It reminded me, in fact, opening the meeting with the Serenity Prayer reminded me of a meeting I went to in another state. It was a fundraiser. It was about this time of the day on a Saturday. It was a one-day event. What they had was a chartered meal at noon on Saturday. They had it one year before, and it turned out well for them. They had 150 people in attendance, and they decided to do it again this next year. But at the last minute, the people that were putting on got a resentment. You know what a resentment is, I forget. And they decided they wouldn't do it. They'd call it off. They ended it. And another group decided they can't do that to us. We'll form our own committee, and we'll put it on. And by God, we'll have 300 people. And they worked real hard. They got the thing set up, and they got the thing going. And they were so successful that instead of having 300, they had 500 people. Well, what that did was to throw a strain on the caterer who wasn't prepared for that, so it made a delay in the meal. And the other thing that happened was that they had invited the local minister to give the invocation, and he hadn't shown up. So I went to one of the old timers and they said, if the minister doesn't show up, will you get up and give the invocation? And he said, well, all right. And he started making some notes as to what he would say. And the caterer kept working and working, and the guy kept writing notes about the invocation. And finally, the caterer was all ready to go and said so, and all the people wanted to get up and go eat. And they said, no, you can't eat yet. You have to have the invocation. So they called up the old-timer, and the old-timer got up to read his invocation. And the first word on the thing was God. And he said, God. And they all recited the Serenity Prayer and got up and ran. And so I guess the only moral to that story is if you're ever asked to give an invocation, don't break God into it too soon. Anyhow, I'm glad to be here. I'm glad Max was here. I'm glad you let her share. I have to say that. I love Al-Anon. In fact, I go to Al-Anon every Monday, tomorrow noon. We'll be going to the meeting. In fact, I'm leading tomorrow morning, tomorrow noon. If you're all in Laguna tomorrow, stop in and we'll show you how to lead a good Al-Anon meeting. I go to Al-Anon with Max. Max comes to AA with me, and we have our two Al-A dogs, Lily and Sabrina, and just like Francine's three Al-A cats. Our dogs come to more meetings than a lot of people that are trying to stay sober. And as I often say, they have better personalities than a lot of people are trying to stay sober. And, I used to make fun of the Al-Anons, and even though our book says they're not at fault, they seem to have been born that way. But I decided Al-Anon jokes are like ethnic jokes. I mean, there's nobody more anxious to see us make it than the Al-Anons, either as an organization or as individuals. So I don't make fun of them, even though they are rather humorous. Max likes to tell the story about how Paula wanted to use our pool for the baptisms, and I thought, gee, how many people do you know have a whole pool full of baptismal water? And I thought, so I agreed to it. He said, well, nothing, I didn't know. And anyway, Max was still annoyed at Ann for doing that, and that was Saturday night by the time they got through and all that. And that's the night for us to go to our big Laguna Beach Canyon Club Saturday night meeting, where I happened to be secretary at the time. And Max decided she couldn't go to the meeting. She had to stay home and watch. She didn't want to watch them, but she wanted to be there to protect the house or whatever it was. I don't know. It didn't make any sense to me that we had to watch her own daughter and her goofy friends. So she didn't come to the meeting. Well, I went on to the meeting by myself, and of course, since we always go to meetings together, people kept asking me, where's Max? Where's Max? And I was getting tired of people asking me, where's Max? Where's Max? And so finally, when I got up to give the announcements as the secretary, I said, Max isn't with me tonight, and everybody keeps asking me, where's Max? Where's Max? Where's Max? And I'm sick of answering the questions, so I'll tell you all. Max got ticked off, and Max is home in bed having an Al-Anon slip. And she got so many phone calls, she's never done that again. It's interesting that we both like the program as much as we do and enjoy this way of life as much as we do, because when you stop and think about how I wasn't even an alcoholic when I came here. No, I wasn't. As she said about her alcoholic uncles, and the Gensline boys were well known in our town that they were alcoholics. And Max and I don't know if I mentioned this or not, but at the end of this year, December the 2nd of this year, Max and I will have been married for 54 years. And we've been emotionally involved with each other to very, very varying degrees of intensity for 70 years. So Wow, he's right. What I started to say was when we grew up together, and as we were growing up, my family didn't like for me to be playing with the Genslein girl because the Genslein boys were alcoholics, and they were afraid that if we were too involved with each other and we got married, that I would turn out to be an alcoholic. And by God, they were right. A lot of people don't know how they got to be alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic by marriage. Not really very funny. I didn't plan on being an alcoholic. In fact, that's how I got the disease. I ended up, as she said, she drove me to drink for years, and then drove me into the nut ward. And from the only way I could get out of the nut ward was to get a pass to go to AA meetings. And I had no intentions of continuing to go to meetings. And I ended up going to these. I finally got discharged from the hospital. I had no intentions of going back to meetings once I got out. But the point was that Max liked the meetings. And, of course, once I found out she liked them, I used that against her. She wouldn't shape up. Then I said, I'm not going to AA anymore. Well, I did that once too often. And she got in the car, and she couldn't drive the freeways, but she did it anyway. She got in the car and drove all the way to Laguna Beach by herself. She would go down to Laguna Beach. She'd go to the AA meetings by herself. Have you ever tried that? Have you ever tried sitting home on a Saturday night drinking while your non-alcoholic spouse is off laughing it up at an AA meeting? I found it boring. I wondered what they were laughing about, and I had to go back to find out what they were laughing about, and I found out that alcoholics laugh at anything. They laugh at things they ought to be ashamed of, for God's sake. They laugh at their drinking, for God's sake. And I thought, it was embarrassing, I thought. In fact, what happened to me was, one night I found myself laughing with them, and I haven't had a drink since. I found out that my higher power laughs every time it hears alcoholics laugh. Even if he doesn't understand the joke, he laughs. he likes to hear him laugh. And I think it has a lot to do with my sobriety. And that took me 7 months of going to meetings to turn into an alcoholic. Well, that's how I found out that it was, it's a contagious disease. I had been raised to think that you got alcoholism by drinking alcohol in bars. You don't get alcoholism, you get drunk drinking alcohol. But you don't get alcoholism from alcohol, you get it from other alcoholics. It's contagious. It's a virus. So, it goes in through your ears. Yeah. It affects your brain. And you get it from other alcoholics. And that's why, in fact, if you're here today and you're not really, really, really an alcoholic, you want to be very careful what you listen to. Anytime you're around alcoholics, be very careful what you listen to. Keep your mind wide open, so whatever goes in goes right on through. And you're around alcoholics and they say something and you think, my God, I felt something like that when I did something similar. You suppose I might be an alcoholic. Boom, you're an alcoholic. And the bad part is that once you suspect it, it's too late. You've already... And you won't get any sympathy from me. You turn to one of the next of them and you say, I think I might be an alcoholic. Oh, we got another one. Raise your hand. You think they got a bonus or a prize on every new member or something. I thought, my God, these people are willing to go to any lengths to get you to join this stupid organization. In fact, they enjoy being alcoholics. In fact, watch it here tonight. Will all the alcoholics please raise your hand? All the alcoholics. See? My God, the place is crawling with them. I've always been impressed with the number of alcoholics that you see at AA meetings. And there was one over here, raised both hands and waved. The big, I tried that at a bar sometime, you know. Just drop in at a meeting, a bar, it's after the meeting. Any alcoholics, please raise your hand. I don't think you'll get the same response. In fact, I don't think there are any alcoholics in the bars. They're all the alcoholics are in the meetings. And the bad part about it is that once you're even a little bit alcoholic, I was hardly alcoholic at all in the beginning. I had one less meeting and I could have then stayed out there, you know. But I was just, when I first, yeah, really. So I went to one meeting too many and turned into a very, very mild alcoholic. In fact, I even had words that I knew I wasn't. Maybe I was allergic to alcohol, but I wasn't a drunkard. I wasn't a skid, oh, I certainly wasn't a skid row bum. I wasn't a lush. I wasn't a wino. But I was kind of allergic to alcohol. Just enough, I had to keep coming back. And then the trouble is, I had to keep coming back, and the more I kept coming back, the more alcoholic I became. And I'm much, much, much more alcoholic today. Much more alcoholic today. Than, much more alcoholic than I was 26 years ago. 26 years ago. And it was a progressive disease when I was drinking, and my disease has progressed since I quit drinking. The nice part about it is the recovery is progressive, too. It's been a progressive disease and a progressive recovery. And once I became an alcoholic, I decided, you know, I better not drink. Because I noticed in AA, they don't like for you to drink. They don't tell you that, but you can tell. I remember that every time I'd quit drinking, and I'd quit drinking many, many, many times, every time that I had quit drinking, I ended up drunk. And I thought, now what am I going to do? Here I'm going to be in AA, I want to be one of the winners in AA, and I don't see winners who drink, but if I quit, I'll get drunk. And I remember this stupid statement that they make, well, you just don't drink one day at a time. It's one drink for one day. Just don't drink one day at a time. One day at a time. I thought, what the hell good would that do to not drink for one day, you know? And I tell that to dummies, but you don't tell that to doctors, for God's sake. So. Well, I didn't know what else to do. So I decided one day, I won't tell anybody, but I just won't drink today and see what happens. Nothing happened. I thought I'd try it another day. And nothing happened that day. And that's the way I do it. I drank many yesterday and I'm going to drink tomorrow, but I don't drink today. In fact, I didn't know if I could keep from drinking today if I didn't know I was going to drink tomorrow. And tomorrow gets here, I check the time. And if it's today, I won't drink today. Yeah. And so I had to do a lot of things to keep from drinking and to be reasonably comfortable to not drinking. That's an important part of my sobriety, is to not drink is one thing, but I want more than to just not drink. Abstinence alone is not recovery, but no recovery can take place without abstinence. But I want more. I want more of what this program has to offer than just to not drink. And so I've had to do all kinds of things to get it. In fact, a lot of times, I used to get upset at Max and drink, and I was sure that she, if you had my wife, you'd drink too, was my mother, and she drove me to drink for all this time, and more recently now in sobriety, a lot of times I'll be upset, and a little voice will say to me, well, is it important? And I'll say, you're damn right it's important, and I want to defend why it's important. And a little voice will say, well, is it worth drinking over? I think, well, hell no, nothing's worth drinking over, for God's sake. Then the little voice will say, well, if you're not going to reward yourself with a drink, why bother to be so upset? You know? And I think, well, screw it, you know. In fact, I remember the time when I gave up drinking, because back in the days before AA, Max thought I was her problem, and I was sure she was my problem. And she was working on me to get me straightened out, and I was working on her to get her straightened out. So that we were, and the harder we worked on each other, the worse it got. And so today we've had to reverse that, and we work on ourselves instead of on each other. And I remember when I first got sober, I wasn't going to drink, but she didn't shape up the minute I quit drinking, and she was hard to live with, and I thought people ought to know. That's right. I mean, why, if you're going to put up with all this crap, I mean, somebody ought to know, by God, what it is. You have to, when you're in the victim role, you've got to let people know it. Or they might expect you to do all the things that other people do. And I thought that's what sponsors were for. And I used to call my sponsor up and tell him about the things she did. And one day she did something really particularly difficult that I can't recall at the moment. And I called my sponsor up, and I started to tell him what she had done. And I don't know whether I called him any one time too often or on a bad day or what it was. I'd hardly even got started, and he interrupted me. And he says, why don't you put it out of your mind a couple of days and see what happens? I said, yeah, a couple of days, I'll forget all about it. Yeah. Yeah. Actually, that's typical of problems. I have more problems with problems. Problems have a very high infant mortality. You can't ignore your problems for hardly any time at all. I mean, you just have to stay right there with them. I mean, have you ever had a problem that you worked on so hard and it was just a delicate, beautiful problem that you really developed? And somebody will say to you, well, this meeting tonight, you're going to be there? And you say, oh, no, I can't come to the meeting. I've got to stay and work on this problem. Yeah. You know that if you go off and waste the whole evening on that meeting, by the time you get back, that problem's liable to be wilted to the point where you can't even bring it back, you know. You can't neglect your problems. That's why the telephone is so important for me. I'll be working on a problem, and the phone will ring, and somebody will be calling me with some stupid little problem. They ought to be able to take care of themselves. Yeah. But you can't give an answer real quick. You've got to be actively interested in them. You have to ask questions and see. That's active listening. That's the in thing today. To be active listening. You see. Yes, things like, well, then what did you do then? And then how did you feel about that? And then what happened, you know? You ask them question after question until neither one of you can stand it anymore, yeah. Then you give them the answer, you know. What's the answer? You pick a number from 1 to 12. And say, they work that step, you know. Yeah. They come back and say, oh, I have the most wonderful sponsor, you know. Unless you picked 4 or 5. I mean, in which case, they don't come back. But you don't want to sponsor people who don't want to do the steps anyhow. That's what it's all about, is nice to. In fact, I see Jim sitting here, Jim and Sandy. Jim's part of our group of 12 that we get together, and what happened was, I got some questionnaires from Texas, where down there several people would get together and form it's not a group, an AA group, but just a meeting, and they would agree to meet every week at the same time for the 20 weeks that it would take, and nobody would drop out, and they wouldn't have other people join in, and they would always do the assignment in the book before the meeting, and when they got to the meeting, they'd go over the part of the book again, and they would study the first 164 pages of the book, and when they came to a step, they would do it, so that it was a step do it, not a step study. And they didn't share fifth steps, but they shared the experience of doing their fourth and fifth step, and so on. So I got that, and there were a lot of typos, some of it was hard to read, and so on. I made that into a pamphlet, and I give those out. This is my, Francine does all kinds of service with a capital S. I do a little service with a small s. This is my kind of service where I distribute the pamphlet free, and then if people want to pay for mailing and postage and printing, and mailing, then I make it available. And we get a group together, and people will and do the steps. The point I wanted to make was that this is my 26th year, and this will be my fifth time to do this, to really do all the steps. And every time I've done it so far, it's raised me to a new plateau in sobriety, just like the first time I did the steps. Now, I know there are people who say, you do the steps once, you never do them again, you just do the maintenance steps. I think the people who do it once and never do it again, they just do the maintenance steps, also just do it once and just do the maintenance steps. And there are other people who want to do the steps over every year, and if you want to do that, that's fine. I'm not telling anybody what they should do, I'm just saying what I do and what has been working for me. And it's been a real interesting experience. I like that, and I appreciate Jim doing that with me. And where that is. Where's that in now? Anyhow. Another thing about the telephone. Whenever I think of it, I give out our phone number. We live in the 714 area. In fact, everybody in our county lives in the 714 area. Our number is 240-3940. And we spend a lot of time on the phone. We have a lot of people call. And it's interesting. When people call, they're calling from the middle of their problem. But when they reach me, I'm in the answer. And it makes it entirely different. It's real interesting to deal with things. And people talk freely over the phone and that. So you call anytime. It's interesting. Because I'm often working on a problem, and I need that phone to ring. And, yeah. I've always believed in the positive power of worry. I always felt that if you worry enough about a problem, it's coming. If you put up a lot of worry, you can put up like a plastic shield that'll protect you from the worry of the problem getting to you. And if it gets to you anyway, it gets over the shield, at least you know you gave it your best shot, by God. You know. Because if you don't worry and it hits you, then you have to worry, you have to feel guilty for not even trying. Anyhow, all the things that I do, having spots, going to meetings, lots of meetings, and working steps, and working with others, and all that stuff, I find it easy to not take a drink today. That's not even an option for me today. It's not. I've made a commitment to being a successful member of AA. I like that word, commitment. I was talking to a fellow the other day, but in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out, never any length of sobriety, on alcohol and cocaine and other drugs. And I said, a young guy. And I said, gee, you're a young guy. A year out of your life would mean nothing. Why don't you make a commitment to total sobriety, the best kind of sobriety you can get, in AA for 1 year? Just come to AA and be the most committed AA member you can be for 1 year. Stay sober, get your cake, celebrate your birthday, and that night, sit down with yourself and decide whether you like that year better than the years before, or you want more of that or more of what you had. And he's been doing that now. It's been just over six months. And it's just working out real well for him. The word commitment has meaning to me. Howard Key down in our area talks about it. He mentioned that when you make a commitment, that Providence moves too. That when you make a commitment to something, Providence moves in and all sorts of things happen that wouldn't otherwise have happened in the absence of the commitment. And I'm committed to AA, and I find it gives me a sense of drive, a sense of goal, and a way to go. And it means to keep me from drinking and drugging is easy for me. And, Max mentioned I took pills. I thought, well, this is an AA meeting. We don't talk about pills. And I think that's fine. But I do feel I need to at least give some brief honorable mention to amphetamines. Why, have you used amphetamines? I never would have guessed. But I never got hooked on. She made it sound that way, but I didn't. I never got hooked. I mean, I don't know that I would have had the stamina to have completed my pre-AA training period if it hadn't been for the amphetamines, but I never got hooked on them. I never got hooked on them. You can't get hooked on them. I ask any doctor, you can't get hooked on pills. You can't get, in the first place, he'll tell you none of his patients ever get hooked on pills, but you can't get hooked on pills unless you abuse them. It's true. You have to abuse the pill in order to get hooked on it. And I never abused a pill in my life. I don't even know how to abuse a pill. How do you abuse a pill? Throw it up against the wall, you stomp on the thing, or verbally abuse it. You dirty, rotten little pill, why don't you do it? I never abused a pill. I mean, they were tiny little pills. I mean, you could tell the look at them. They were very mild, and I was even very careful where I carried my pills. The little pocket inside the big pocket, that's the pill pocket. That's where you keep your pills. I used to carry, for a start out, I carried more of my change. People say, you got change for a dollar? I say, yeah, and I go like that. And they say, oh, you carry second all around in the daytime, you know. So I switched them over with my keys, and then I go out to get in the car, and I take the keys out of my pocket, and a quaalude run down the street. Damn thing would always run faster than I could run. And I didn't dare stomp on it or I'd abuse it. I never abused a pill in my life. In fact, I never ever took a pill. It wasn't medically indicated at the time. I had the symptom. I had the symptom that only that pill would relieve. It was, I either had it or I could feel it coming on. And every pill was taken according to directions and prescribed by a doctor. My problem today. My problems today are not related to drinking. Haven't had a problem as a result of drinking since the last time I took a drink. My problems today are all related to my thinking. In fact, I don't even have a problem today, unless I think I do. Just think about that for a minute. I have never, ever thought I had a problem and been wrong. If I think I have a problem, I have a problem. If I think it's a big problem, it's a big problem, no matter what anybody else thinks. If I think it's a little problem, just a little problem, no matter what anybody else. Don't have many little problems. I don't bother with them. It's like resentments. I don't bother with any but the justifiable ones. I shouldn't tell this story. It's not my story, but it's not even a story. It's a true fact. I was reading David Biscott, the psychiatrist on TV, radio, books. I was looking through one of his books. He has several books. It's one of his books on emotional problems and how you deal with them. And I was leafing through it, and he had a thing on resentment. And I thought, well, he can't tell us anything about resentment. But I'll see what he has to say anyway after reading through the thing. He says, you have resentment against somebody, you write their name on a piece of paper. I thought, okay, I'll write it. Write it in bold letters, he says. Okay, I'll write it in bold letters. Then he says, you tear it up. I thought, okay, I'll tear it up. He says, you tear it up vigorously. I'll tear it up vigorously. And he said, you throw it in the toilet. Okay, I'll throw it in the toilet. And he says, then you use the toilet. I thought, how can we combine something as crude as that, that with our program of praying for the person? And then a little voice in my head says, well, you could pray for the SOB while you're using the toilet. In fact, that's what my life consists of. People in my head talking. People. Anytime I'm thinking, somebody's talking. I say, as long as I'm awake, somebody's talking. Even when I'm asleep, they're talking. A lot of times in the morning, I wake up and my mood is set by what they've been telling me. And I don't even remember what they were telling me, but I just have the mood. That's why I needed early morning meetings 7 days a week in order to, because my day could be ruined. It hadn't even started yet. And I couldn't wait till night to get straightened out. AA's attitude, or attitude adjustment. And AA is altered attitude is what I was trying to say. But I had to have it in the morning as well as at night. But my life consists of the voices talking to me all the time, talking. In fact, even now, it's like this room. You're sitting here very quietly, and there are people in my head. They're up there, and they're talking. They're talking. And I'm trying to keep my focus on what I'm saying to you, but they're talking. And not only that, they get to discussing among themselves what I ought to be talking about. And they say, no, don't have them talk about that. Talk about this. And I start talking about this, and they want to talk about that. And my mind gets here, and I think, my God, why don't you shut up there? You know, and they all get startled and shut up, and I can't think of anything to say. And they, It isn't my life. It isn't what happens in my life that determines my life. It's what they think about what happens, and it's their comments about what happens. It's that my whole life is revolves around them up there, and there are all these people up there, and each one has their own single pet focus. Yourself. For instance, there's one of them up there. There's one of them up there who is obsessed with Max. He always has been. As long as he's known her, we've known her, he's been obsessed with her and what she does and how she does it. And he doesn't particularly like her. And he loves to point out to me, did you hear what she just said? Did you notice her tone of voice? Does she know who she's talking to? And yet, there's another one up there, the same obsession. It's the same obsession with Max, but he likes Max. He does. And he loves to point out things like, doesn't she have a great sense of humor? Aren't you lucky you have her? You know, isn't it great that she kept going to AA when you didn't want to go? Isn't it great that she's so active in Al-Anon? Doesn't she have a great spiritual program? You know, my marriage depends on who I listen to. And I didn't know I had a choice. In fact, when you don't know you have a choice, you don't have a choice. But my life depends on who I listen to up there. There are people up there that tell me what a great day it is. And there are people up there that tell me what a crappy day this is. In fact, I'm convinced in the law of appreciation. Keep looking at my watch because we promised the end at 1:30. If you're beginning to wonder what time this is going to be over, but I've become very interested in the law. It's called the law of appreciation. The law of appreciation says that in this life, every person, place, thing, situation, institution, corporation, or any combination thereof has both good and bad in it. That's just the way it is. It's just the way it is. That's the way it's always been. That's the way it always will be. If there's a place called heaven, maybe up there everything will be 100% good. If there's a place called hell, maybe everything will be 100% bad. But where we are, it's both good and bad. And our choice is, whether it's a choice or not, what we do is we either look at the good or look at the bad. The important point is that when I look at the good, it keeps getting gooder. And when I look at the bad, it keeps getting badder. My mind is like an energy factory. It puts energy into whatever I think about. That's why gratitude lists work for me. No matter what kind of a day I'm having, if my sponsor says make a gratitude list, I start making out the things I have to be grateful for, I end up feeling grateful. And that's where I put my focus. That's why I can have a bad day, and I can go to a meeting, and even if it isn't what you'd call a good meeting, I can end up feeling better when I leave. It's because I've been living in the problem. I go to the meeting, I'm living in the answer. In fact, my mind was distracted as I said something about going to a meeting. It wasn't a good meeting. I have an old-timer in my morning meeting. He said the other day, he says, I've never been to a bad meeting. I thought, oh, God. He says, no, he says, I've never been to a bad meeting, but I sure have been to some long ones. But I need to keep my focus on either how good things are or how bad things are. And my day is created by what I keep my focus on and what the people, it isn't what happens to me, it's what I think about what happens that determines my life today. And in fact, the more I think in terms of spiritual things, the more spiritual I become. The more I think in terms of loving things, the more loving I become. I was talking about AA, or by now, alcoholism being a contagious disease, a virus. What I like to think of an alcoholic or other chemically dependent person as being a person who, whether they want to or not, and perhaps even more so if they don't want to, but whether they want to or not, they generate a great deal of love and lack the ability to express love. Now, if you generate love and you lack the ability to express it, that's an emotion and it keeps building up inside and creating discomfort. They put in alcohol and drugs to suppress those feelings. Seems to help. But because it compounds the communication problem, it makes it worse. Not only does it get worse, but not only can the alcoholic not express love, he can't receive it. So that those who love us can't express their love either. But it keeps building up, and it can't express it. Can't come out as love. Has to come out some way. But it comes out as negative emotions. Frustration, resentment, anger, hostility, violence. All of which compound the communication problem. So it's a progressive disease. It keeps getting progressively worse. No answer to that. Can't go to a doctor and just give you pills. You've already tried those. What happens to people like that? They end up as a newcomer in AA or Al-Anon. What do we do with newcomers? Seems to me we love the hell out of them. We love the hell out of their hellish lives. We don't even call it that, but we demonstrate it. We demonstrate love. We tell them, well, look at the countdowns. Look how, weren't those countdowns great last night and Friday night? And how we show the newcomer how important they are to us. Because as I see it, they're very important to us. We'd die without them. As I see it, alcoholism is a disease, a medical problem. That's one. Two, we have a spiritual answer to that medical problem. And three, part of that spiritual answer is we have to give it away to keep it. If we don't give it away, we can't keep it. So we need the newcomers. There's no risk involved because they're making them faster than we're curing them. The thing is that it's showing them that's a loving thing to make the other person feel important. In fact, we do that at meetings. As I see it, that's what a meeting's all about. We're talking about meetings of whether you go to meetings because you have to or go to meetings because you want to. You go there for what you can get out of it, or do you go there for what you can give to it? And it seems to me it's an act of love just to sit in a meeting. Just to sit silently. Because you're doing that now. You've got lots of other things you could be doing right now, but you're sitting at a meeting listening to an alcoholic stand up here and talk. That's a very loving thing to do, to just sit quietly and pretend like you're interested and pretend like you care, and whether you are or not. And it's also, as was I think Francine mentioned last night, coming up at the podium and sharing and talking and spilling your guts and taking the risk, or what seems like a risk, of being honest. And that it's an act of love to get up here. It's an act of love to be down there. And we take turns back and forth doing that. And I think we just love each other to help. Love each other to help. And it seems to me we can take that same act of love, or that same willingness to make the other person feel important, we can take that home. We can take that communication skills that we learn here home. I was reading something, reading about David and Vera Mace, husband and wife, both of whom were marriage, family, child counselors, had been for 50 years. For 25 years, they worked with marriages and relationships in trouble. And for 25 years, they worked in what they called marriage enrichment. They were relationships that were doing well but wanted to do even better. They thought this is a wonderful opportunity to see why some relationships work out and some don't. They looked to see what problems the relationships that broke up, what problems they had, what broke up the relationship. And they found out they were like sex, kids, in-laws, money. They looked at the marriages, the relationships that were doing well to see if they had problems, and they found out that their problems were sex, money, in-laws, kids. You know, same deal, but so that the problems weren't what caused the thing to break up. They checked into it further, and after 50 years of study, they came to the conclusion that the relationships that did well had three things that the other did not lacked. And to paraphrase what they found out, they said, one, that the relationships that did well had a mutual concern for the partner's spiritual and emotional growth. A mutual willingness to learn and to practice communication skills. And a mutual interest in dealing with problems creatively. In other words, it had to do with an interest in your partner's growth, spiritual and emotional, an interest in learning and practicing communication skills, and an interest in dealing with problems creatively. I thought, that is a tremendously big order. Who could ever do all that? But the more I think about it, that's the AAL non-problem program. That's what we do. We're interested in each other's spiritual and emotional growth, and we're interested in dealing with things, learning communication, and with dealing with problems creatively. If you're not going to drink over a problem, you got to find an answer to it. You're not going to break up. That's one of the things Max and I decided a long time ago. It doesn't necessarily work for anybody else, but it does for us, that we decided we were not going to divorce. And if you're not going to drink over it, you're not going to leave over it, hell, you're stuck. You've got to think of it. You have to think of an answer. Otherwise, you're feeling miserable all the time. Let me say this. I was thinking of a graph of my life. And my life started way, way over there, and it's going to end way, way, way over there. And from where it started until July 31st, 1967, it was on a downhill course. It wasn't a straight line down. It was up and down, up and down. But I think I would have recognized it sooner. I don't know if I'd have been able to do anything about it, but I would have recognized it sooner. But it wasn't a straight line down. It was up and down. And it just kept getting worse and worse until I ended up in the nut ward of the hospital I was on the staff of. And that wasn't bad enough. I had to go to AA. And after 7 months of AA, I turned into a mild alcoholic. And my life has been getting better and better and better ever since. And it's been getting just better and better. Now, it's not a straight line. It's up and down, up and down. When I first would go down, pain feels like pain. And I think, my God, there's no use being sober. This is just as bad as it was. But I realized that it's not as bad, and there are all kinds of things I can do to get over the pain. And the only things, there are a lot of things I can do so that I'll feel better in the pain now that I didn't know back then. Plus the fact that I don't even have to do anything, and I know it'll get better. Because that's the only Bible quote I use. The Bible
doesn't say, and it came to stay.
The Bible says, and it came to pass. I just keep going to meetings, working the steps, calling my sponsor, reading the book. It'll pass, and it'll get better. And it's not always the same. Now, some days are better, some weeks are better, some months are better, some years are better than others. And the trend is better. And it seems to me the only limit as to how good it can get for me is how long I can stay around doing what I'm doing. And I'm going to keep doing it and see what happens. And it amazes me what was the cause of that V, the shape? What caused the change in direction of that? And it all seems to come back to the fact that I accepted the fact that I, of all people, strange as it might seem, am a mild alcoholic. And I look back, the more I resisted being an alcoholic, the worse it got. And the more I accept it, the better it gets. It's the same with marriage. If I resist the marriage, it gets worse. If I accept it as it is, it gets better. And it seems to me that's true of everything about life. The more I resist it, life seems to love the challenge. If I say, I don't like it the way it is, and I'm not going to accept it until it gets better, it keeps getting worse. And when I accept the way it is, it gets better and better. And it doesn't have anything to do with approval, as Max said. Approval doesn't precede acceptance, it follows it. And if out in the real world, if you don't approve of something, you don't accept it. You're a wimp if you do. But in God's world, it has nothing to do with acceptance. I don't know that. As far as I know, God doesn't even have an 800 customer relations number. I can't imagine one of his angels running up to God and saying, "Oh God, God, we got a problem. Paul doesn't like the day we're sending him." I can just imagine him saying, "Well, you can tell him where to go." And I think it's time for me to go. Thank you all very much. I love you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.